Okay, good morning, everyone. We only have 9 folks, but thank you very much for being here. It is the 14th of April, and the world is very strange indeed. And what can we say? Today we are going to finish up chapter 7 with some, I think, some, are you saying something, Frank? Yes, I am. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Andres? No. Okay, how about everybody else? Anyone else hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. Andres? Alejandro? And Samuel, did you have your Andres? Turn off your mute your audio. There you go. Now, can you hear me now, Andres? Use the chat. Okay, great. Okay, there you go. Okay, great. Okay, great. I know it's strange. We haven't been Zoom bombed. Yes, if we are Zoom bombed, just I'll shut down the. Let's do this. Share the screen. Multiple. Only the host can share the screen. If we are Zoom bombed, a bunch of people jump in and start screaming and hollering, we'll shut down the Zoom session, and then we will restart it. So, and then there'll be a what's called a waiting room. So you'll have to identify yourself. It'll just take a whole lot of time, but at least we can't get people who are subhumans, Trump supporters into the Zoom room. Okay, so today we're going to finish up chapter 7. We're going to do some. We're going to take a look at some all what I call the all stars of investing. And in my humble opinion, when you are interested in doing something well, especially that's, you know, that takes some serious talent and some training and the like, I try to look at the people who are good at it, you know, and say, okay, what made them good at it, and what can I do to emulate them? And then we have some silliness, a little bit of silliness from chapter 7, and then we have some serious silliness in chapter 8 to go through. But first, there are actually some ideas in chapter 8 that are useful, not only because they're good for investing, they're just useful because we're humans, and humans are not rational as much as we'd like to think we are. Okay, so but first we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? I got an Easter joke. Was it a happy Easter for you? What do you get when you cross an anesthesiologist with a rabbit? An anesthesiologist with a rabbit? The ether bunny. The ether bunny? Yeah, did you get it? I don't know. I can't hear you, but it's okay. Okay. So let's... I know that you expect the jokes to get better, even in the depth of the turmoil. The jokes don't get any better. All right, so let's get started. Okay. So I'm going to share the screen. No, this button right there. Share the screen. Here we are. Share. Okay, so now you should be seeing the Yahoo, right? Everybody should see that. Okay, let's make this a little lower. There we go. And it turns out, dear students, that we're coming back. You didn't give up. And sure enough, the two companies that had exploded on us have come back the best. The Virgin Galactic and the Tesla. And look who's the worst is Wells Fargo, which is the one you would expect to hold up the best. But no, in a recession, what happens? The banks don't make as much money. There's not as much lending going on. Interest rates fall. So they don't make as much money. But as a long-term investment, Wells Fargo ain't going anywhere. So I wouldn't be too worried about that. And then... who was our Brookfield Renewable Partners? I keep telling myself I want to take a look closer at that company because they look pretty interesting. All right, so you want to change anything? You want to sell anything? Get out while the good getting's good? We're only down 12%, a little over 12%. Sell everything? No? Hang on to it? Watch it fizz? Because if you go online to, you know, the Yahoos and the Market Watches and if or CNBC or wherever you go to look for financial stuff, you'll see tons of articles about, are we at the bottom? Yes, we're at the bottom. No, we're not at the bottom. And yeah, nobody really knows. But your humble instructor believes that, no, no, there's going to be another drop. Because why? It looks like we're going to open up the try to reopen up the economy at the end of April or beginning of May or maybe the end of May. And then there's going to be another surge of this horrible virus. And so people will then panic. So that's what I'm thinking. But doesn't mean I'm right. Who knows? We might be at the bottom. We might have a long way far to go. Okay, so that's it for there. So back up, back up. We're back over 12% now. So let's now jump to chapter 7. Okay, so this is where we were. Let's see if I can get this to work right. Present. Presenter view. Close that. Yeah, here we are. So we had gone through the efficient market theorist, and we said that the efficient market theorists don't believe in fundamental analysis, what we've done in chapters 5 and 6 and then 17, where we looked at the company itself and said, you know, what are the prospects for this company? We looked at their competitors and their suppliers and their customers and the market, their industry. And they say, don't even bother. They also say, technical analysis, which we should get to today, don't even bother because that's voodoo. They believe you should only invest in index funds because nobody can beat the market. But of course, we're going to see people who have beaten the market over decades. So obviously they're not correct. And we want to emulate them. We might not be them. We might not become the next Warren Buffett or Sir John Templeton or Peter Lynch. But we can learn from them. But first, let's take a look at some silliness. If you're involved in investing in any time, for any length of time, and by the way, I'm going to mute my my. You don't need to see my talking head. Okay, no, not the. I muted the wrong thing. I'm going to mute my video because you don't need to see my talking head, but you do need to hear me. So let's close that. Okay, so now if you're involved in investing in any length of time, I wish I could keep the chat going. This is. I'm going to learn how to use this thing eventually, dear students. The chat. It doesn't show up. I don't understand why not. Okay, it doesn't. Hang on, disconnect that. Sorry, I'm doing some little in-flight maneuvers. Can you still hear me, folks? Let's start the video again. And then start the chat again. Can you still hear me? Oh, darn it, why does... Yeah, okay, great, great, thanks. Your internet connection is unstable. See, I'm having trouble here. Can you hear me, folks? Somebody yell out.
We can hear you.
Okay, good, okay. Because the chat disappears, and I don't know why that chat disappears. I don't like it to disappear. So in case somebody's yelling at me saying, I can't hear you anymore. Okay, so I'm going to mute the... video. Maybe I shouldn't. I should leave the video on. Because if I mute the video, the chat disappears. Okay, that's what I'll do. Okay. I'll just leave the video on. You get to see my ugly mug. All right. So if you're involved in investing in any length of time, what's going to happen is you're going to start to hear things about the Monday effect or the January effect or the Santa Claus rally or sell in May and go away. And these are just... sayings that people throw about as if they really knew what the hell was going on. They don't. The Monday effect. That's the best day to buy, or is it the best day to sell? Well, if you're thinking about buying one day and selling the next day, you're not an investor. You're a trader, and trader with a D, speculator. And I wish you a lot of success, but that's not what this class is about, as we've said over and over again. And then you'll hear people talk about what's called the January effect. If January does well, then the rest of the year is going to do well. Well, it's ridiculous. I mean, there's a sense of newness to the year. It's a new year. But if you look at, say, May, or, another month, often that month will do well, and then the rest of the year will do fine. You know, because the market, as we said, has a bias to go up over time as the global economy expands and as we all have a better life and a higher standard of living. So I think this is ridiculous. And then in December, there's often what is called a Santa Claus rally, the turn of the year effect. And there's some truth to this, because what happens is, as we've seen, September and October are often the worst months of the year. Statistically, it doesn't mean any one year they're going to be bad. Sometimes they're good years. And so when you hear people say sell in May and go away, what they're meaning is, look, between November and April and May are often the best months. And between May to September and October are often the worst months, because September and October are not good. And we talked about that yesterday. Last Thursday. I think it's because of we're humans and we just panic that time. But that doesn't always happen that way. And again, we're long-term investors, so we don't care. And then they'll trot out this Super Bowl theory, where when the National League wins, that's a bullish indicator. The market's going to go up. When the American League wins, that's a bearish. And you go back in time, and it turns out it's kind of true. And you go, well, wait a minute. What would the Super Bowl have anything to do with the economy and stocks and the like? And then you look at some of these others. I have some of them on my homepage, where they look at the comparison of the number of PhDs in biophysics with the amount of cheese consumption in December. And it turns out that it's perfectly aligned. And you go ask yourself, well, maybe it's just a coincidence. And yeah, it's just a coincidence. So don't put any credence in any of that. Hemlines of skirts in the 1920s and the 1960s, skirts went up and so did the market. And then in the 1930s and 1970s, skirts went down and so did the market. So, right. Yeah. And then there's the lipstick indicator. The more lipstick is purchased, that's a good sign, or maybe it's a bad sign. How much snow is in Boston? That's called the BS indicator. The hot waitress indicator and the aspirin count theory. Exactly. These are just ridiculous. But because of all the money that can be made and lost in the capital markets, people give credence to them. And then what about politics? Politics. You know, poly means many, and ticks are blood-sucking insects, right? Well, you will, if you follow politics, get the impression, at least they will do their best to give you the impression, that the Republicans are actually better for the markets than the Democrats. And the truth is, dear students, that it's the other way around. The markets have done better during Democratic administrations than they've done during Republican administrations. Having said that, we should back up and say, look, the president really doesn't have a whole lot to do with the economy. They are an important cheerleader, you know, they can do stupid things like start trade wars, but they really don't have much to do with it. It's more you and I getting up in the morning, putting on our pants, going to work and buying and consuming and producing the goods and services. That's more important. And part of the reason the Democrats have done well is, and the Republicans have not done as well, is just dumb luck. For example, in the 1920s, That's when Herbert Hoover took over right before the Great Depression and the market lost 80-some percent. And then FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, comes in, and it's at the depth of the Depression, so you can't start at any better place than that, and it comes back. The same thing happened in the 1970s. The early 1970s, the market lost about almost 50%, and that's when Nixon and Ford were in, and then it comes back when Jimmy Carter was in. And the same thing happened in the 2000s, 1990s, 2000s. We had Clinton, and the market just went in two directions in the late 90s, up and way up. And then in 2000 is when it turned, just in time for George Bush the younger to come in. So a lot of it is just bad timing on the part of the Republicans. So don't let anybody tell you that the Republicans are better, the Democrats are better. They both parties believe in free market enterprise. Believe now there is some discussion about regulations and free markets and how free should free markets be and how much protection do people need. So yeah, we can scream and holler about that forever, but in general, just don't worry about the politics, unless you would have a demagogue who would say things like, well, capitalism is horrible. Capitalism is horrible. It's probably the worst economic system ever devised, except for all the others. it's not perfect. Nothing's perfect. We're humans. But it's a hell of a lot better than anything else we've come up with. When something else comes along and it turns out it's better than capitalism, if it turns out it is better than capitalism, I don't think it will, then let's take a look, see. But I'm not buying it. Okay, so that's some of the silliness. Now, let's continue. Oops, let's continue here. All right, so now, what we're going to do, my fault, we're on slide 16. How are we doing for time? I spent too much time on that slide. I apologize. Let's take a look at some of the all-stars of investing. And these are stories that I'll try to keep as quickly, as short as possible. But these people really do bear investigation. Read about them. Read Peter Lynch's book. Read about Warren Buffett. There's a biography about him. There's several, but the one that's authorized is called Snowball. And then Benjamin Graham, you're going to read eventually The Intelligent Investor, and then Sir John Templeton. And these people are extraordinary, right? If you're a sports fan, they're the all-stars of investing, as opposed to all-stars of sports or all-stars of opera or whatever. And Peter Lynch was we've made mention to him. He ran the Fidelity Magellan Mutual Fund, which we included in Chapter 4 as one of the really good mutual funds, but it was the reason it's done so well is because of the 12 years that he ran it. He ran it and racked up 29% a year over 12 years, and then retired because he was too stressed out. And he made enough money, and he didn't want to be part of it anymore. But he would tell people, and you should read One Up on Wall Street. Buy what you know. Look, you. What are you interested in? What are the things that interest you? Maybe sports, right? Okay, what companies are involved in sports? Well, there's Under Armour and Nike and. And oh, you tell me, I'm not a big sports fan. But those are the companies you should investigate. Now, it doesn't mean you should buy them. It's just you understand the industry, and so you have a one-up on Wall Street, he calls it. You have a leg up on the folks who are on the 23rd floor in New York studying screens. You can see people buying and selling and interested in these individual companies and their products. Warren Buffett, we've made mention of him, and he was the student of Benjamin Graham. He says, look, don't buy a stock, you buy a company. Right, we've said that. After you've done all the research on the stock, the company, would you want to buy the entire company? Okay, you don't have $98 billion to buy FedEx. All right, whatever the market cap of FedEx is now. Buy 10 shares. And now he's big enough, he actually goes out and buys the whole company, right? When he has billions of dollars to go out and actually buy entire companies. So his company, Berkshire Hathaway, owns Dairy Queen and See's Candy and Geico Insurance, and they own big chunks of Coca-Cola and McDonald's. They own a railroad, Burlington Santa Fe. So he puts in practice what he believes. And as we said, he was the student of Benjamin Graham, who eventually, folks, don't read it first, but The Intelligent Investor is a book you're going to want to read eventually. Read One Up on Wall Street, Random Walk Down Wall Street first, because they really do give you a better, cursory, but a more popular view of investing. I shouldn't use the word popular. But just a common sense view of investing. And then read The Intelligent Investor, where he really digs deep into analysis. And then Security Analysis is the second one, which is really tough. John Templeton, one of the first mutual fund investors to invest globally. Very, very Sir John Templeton. And all these people, just read about them because they're awesome. So let's take a look now on slide 17, Bill Miller. Bill Miller's still around. I thought he retired and was going to leave, but he came back, and he's doing a few other things. I haven't followed him too much. But he did something that no one else has done. For 15 calendar years in a row, he beat the Standard & Poor's 500. And that was from like 92 to 2007 or so, 91 to 2006. And in my humble opinion, it was unfortunate because now he's the financial media's megastar and everybody's listening to every word he has to say. But then in 2006 and 2007 and 2008, he just got clobbered. Well, why? He was the kind of investor that concentrated. He ran a mutual fund called the Legg Mason Value Trust, which we discussed back in Chapter 4, right? It's now called Clearwater or Clearbridge Value Trust. And he would take his mutual fund and only buy about 40 stocks, which we remember you have to have at least 20, but still you want to have, most mutual funds have at least 100, 150, some have more. And so it works great when you concentrate your portfolio. It works great as long as you do well, right? As long as your companies are going up. But if a few companies don't do well, it can just destroy your returns. And that's exactly what happened. He just got clobbered, and then eventually they let him retire in 2012, and the Legg Mason Value Trust, now called the Clearbridge Value Trust, has never recovered, or at least so far hasn't recovered. It's still in existence. And by the way, Legg Mason got bought by somebody else, and so, you know, it's the glory. It's amazing how far you can fall in this industry. What do all these people have in common? They have the courage to not follow the crowd because the conventional wisdom is usually not very wise. And you'll hear people say the same thing over and over and over again, and all they're doing is just talking to one another, saying the same thing, and it makes them feel like, oh yeah, he said it too, so it must be true. But it's not always the case. It's just not always the case. You know, people, some of you weren't around, but late 90s, everybody's going to get rich. You know, internet, blue skies, and they have what I like to call a sixth sense for unrecognized value. They see something that everybody else is missing, and that's difficult. You know, it's like a sixth sense, just to sniff out value. And here's a great story from this was back in the late 80s, early and into the 90s. The two best chess players in the world, Garry Kasparov and Anatoly Karpov, were playing one another every year. One would become the world champion. Next year, the other one would become the world champion. And they just kept beating each other until finally Kasparov became the undisputed champion. And then he was beaten by the computer, Deep Thought. He was asked once in an interview, why was he and Anatoly Karpov the two best chess players in the world? And his answer was astonishingly simple and direct. We attack better than anybody else, and we defend better than anybody else. Yes, there are people who can do it. And whether it's stocks or whether it's chess or singing an opera or hitting a fastball at 98 miles. There are people who are very good at this. And as we said, the more they practice, the luckier they get. These people, these all-stars of investing, bought the best companies and they avoided the worst companies. And hopefully now you'll kind of see why we in this class go to great lengths to try to show you the kind of companies that could really, you know, sure, if they do well, they could make you really wealthy, but there's more of a chance of them just, you know, destroying your long-term results. So, speaking of avoidance, as a mutual fund manager, mutual fund investor, because which is mostly what I am. I have a few stocks, but mostly we put every in the Roth IRA, in the 403B, everything in the mutual funds. I'm not looking to find the next Peter Lynch or the next Bill Miller or the next Warren Buffett. I'm looking to avoid the next Charles Stedman. And there's a reason why you've never heard of Charles Stedman, right? He ran his own mutual fund, the Stedman American Industry Fund, from December 1959 until his death in late 1997. And his cumulative total return was minus 42.9%. This is during one of the largest expansions of the economy in the history of the world, and he lost 43%. He would have done better simply putting his money into a savings account, right? At least he wouldn't have lost 43%, or putting it under a mattress. Maybe he came from the life insurance industry where they love to lose money. Anyway, so you understand? That's why I'm not looking for people, that hot guy who gal who just did fabulously last year. I want to know how well they've done over 30, 40, 50 years. And then I can be pretty much assured that they're not going to do a Stedman. Okay? So here's what these people say. And these are often quoted quotes from these people. So there are many, many others. This one is quoted often. Warren Buffett says, look, be fearful when others are greedy. Be greedy when others are fearful. And we've talked about this, right? You see a bunch of people running that way. Ooh, wait, me some too. Is it too late to get in? And so we're humans. We follow them. And then we see a whole bunch of people running the other way. Ooh, is it too late to get out? And Mr. Buffett was just channeling his teacher, his mentor, who said it, but see, this is what the way Benjamin Graham writes. That's why we don't want you to read it first, because he writes in a way that's a little messy. But buy when most people, including experts, are overly pessimistic and sell when they are actively optimistic. So he's just saying it a little differently, not as easily understood as Mr. Buffett. That's why we want you to read The Intelligent Investor after you've gone through One Up on Wall Street, Random Walk Down Wall Street. Here, Mr. Sir John Templeton, pretty good for a kid from Tennessee, right? They made him a knight. Bear markets are born of pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. The time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy. So you understand what he's saying? He's, look, you know, we are in the depths of pessimism. That's the best time to buy. Once everyone's euphoric and yay, we're all going to get rich, that's the worst time to buy. That's the time you should be selling. But if we're long-term investors, we don't care. On a similar note, he said, to buy when others are despondently selling and sell when others are avidly buying requires the greatest fortitude and pays the greatest reward. So that's basically, you know, basically what Warren Buffett and Benjamin Graham said. But did Mr. Sir John Templeton follow his advice? You bet he did. December 6th, 1941. You history buffs. What happened on December 6th, 1941? You can type it if you want, or turn on your microphone and yell it out. Anybody? Exactly. We had the bombing of Pearl Harbor, December 6th, 19... Yeah. What?
That was December 7th.
Oh, December 7th. Can you take a joke? You sure it wasn't No, yeah, yeah, it's the 7th. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, you know, here it is that the entire, or one third of the Pacific fleet was destroyed in one day, and the Nazis, Germany, had overrun Europe and were in overrunning the Soviet Union. What did John Templeton do? He calls up his broker and says, "I want you to buy every bankrupt company on the New York Stock Exchange." Right. Here he goes. He's buying the, not only is he buying, he's buying companies that are bankrupt. He just, this is the time to buy. Maximum pessimism. 4 years later, the war was over. And Mr. Templeton is a very wealthy man. Okay, would you have that kind of courage? I know I probably would. I know I wouldn't. So here are some famous myths and stupid sayings you're going to hear people say. And this is mostly from Peter Lynch's book. So I'll give him credit. I added a few, but they're mostly from him. It can't go any lower. You hear people say that. It can't go any lower. I remember WorldCom. Now, you guys don't know who WorldCom was. You're too young. But it was one of the casualties of the internet bubble. And it was like 25 cents or 50 cents. And one of my clients said, "Let's buy it." I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "It can't go any lower." Yes, it can. Once it hits zero, then it can't go any lower. Until it hits zero, it can go lower. And sure enough, it became worthless. It can't go any higher. This is what you heard about Philip Morris in the 1970s and 80s, selling cigarettes. You heard it about Apple nowadays and the other companies. No, there's no limit on how high it can go. If the earnings are continuing to grow, the company should do well. It's only $3 a share. What can I lose? $3, right? It doesn't matter what the price is. It can go to zero. You can lose all your money. Price is irrelevant. Valuation is the key. Market capitalization is the key. Earnings are the key. And you'll hear people say it has to come back. Well, have you ever heard of Penn Central? Penn Station in where the Marvin Gardens, not the Marvin Gardens. What's the very famous the very famous New York arena, whatever it's called. It starts with an M. It was the largest bankruptcy in history at the time. And a company that had been around for 150 years, Penn Central, the very famous railroad company, went bankrupt and disappeared. There's so many examples of companies that you just, they have to come back. Like Kodak, they have to come back. Like Transworld Airlines, they have to come back. No, some companies are going to disappear and they're not going to come back. It's always darkest before the dawn. Well, you know, sometimes it's always darkest before it's pitch black. I love that saying. Sometimes it does, you know, the company does come back. But these are turnarounds. We like to call them goners. Now, here's something we'll revisit when we get to Chapter 8. When it rebounds to $10, I'll sell. The stock has no idea you bought it at $10. If you would now not buy it at this price, it's time to sell and recognize that you made a mistake. What happens is people will buy it at 10, now it's at 6. And they say, "Well, I want to admit I made a mistake." So they'll wait for it stubbornly to go back to 10, and then they'll sell so they can say, "I got out without a loss." But it's about not about the past, it's about the future. If you wouldn't buy it now at 6, if you don't think it's a good deal now, it's time to sell. Here's something where people are trying to protect you against the downside, against the price collapsing. And again, many traders, speculators use this technique. If it goes down 10%, sell. Well, I understand, or 20%. They're trying to keep you from losing a lot of money. But the problem is stock prices fluctuate greatly. Even blue chip companies, as we saw last month or couple months, if you sold each stock that lost 10%, you're going to sell everything. You're never going to hold on to anything. So we'll talk about winners and losers in Chapter 8 in just a few minutes. It's taking too long. That's what you hear people say. And that's when they want to shoot for the fences. They want to swing for the fences, throw the Hail Mary pass, if we use sports analogies. it takes a time. Unless you are really good, folks, want John Merriweather buying and selling, and good luck with that. It's going to take a while, but that's good because it gives you a chance to buy more, right? You're going to be buying, some of you, your Roth IRA, $50, $100 a month, your 401k. You want it to go up slowly because you want to buy now at a lower price. Look at all the money I lost. I didn't buy it. Coulda, woulda, shoulda. You did not lose a cent by not buying a stock that did well. Don't fret over it. I missed that one. I'll catch the next one. Well, the problem is the next one rarely makes it. You know, you're going to wait for the next Google? No, because there's not going to be another Google. Well, maybe. Facebook is trying to be the next Google, right? And why? How are they doing it? Well, they're not doing it the way Google does it because nobody's going to beat them on that. Yahoo and Bing showed that. No, what Facebook tries to do is, look, hey, Google makes money off of advertising, and you type into Google whatever you're interested in, horseshoes or I don't know, whatever you're interested in, baseball. And so they send you ads having to do with the thing that you searched for. Well, Facebook says, no. We're going to determine what that person wants before they even ask for it, based on their friends and what they like, and you know, who they use these algorithms to determine what you're going to want before you even want it. And so they're trying to leapfrog Google, and they've been somewhat successful. Where is sometimes a situation where the next one does arrive? Look at Home Depot. Home Depot pioneered the big box hardware store, basically what it is, right? And then Lowe's came up, and they let Lowe's sort of sneak up on them. But usually the next one, you got to look at another industry. The stock has gone up. I must be a genius. Never mistake a bull market for brains, dear students. That's an old Wall Street saying. You'll hear people say, I got in right when the market exploded and I thought I was invulnerable. Everything I bought turned to gold. What a bad deal that was. Because then when a bear market comes along, they realize, Warren Buffett likes this one saying, when the tide goes out, you can see who's swimming naked. The stock has gone down. I must be an idiot. No, again, it's the same thing in reverse. You're going to make mistakes, so don't be cruel to yourself. You know, you're not going to get everyone right, but that's cool. It's okay because you don't have to. You're going to do pretty darn well if you simply just do the research that we discussed, keep your eyes wide open, and the world doesn't end. It's different this time. Well, technically, yes, it's different every time, but that doesn't mean you should pay an astronomical price for a company that probably will never make a dollar's worth of profit. And this is what was going on in the late 90s. And this is what is going right now. Who knows what's going on? But the last few years with the marijuana stocks, some of these companies are just going to disappear. They're going to turn into nothing. And some people are saying, but yes, I agree. Eventually, marijuana is going to become legal someday. Who knows? We can't continue to put all these people behind bars for selling a weed. But until that happens, you don't know what's going to happen to these companies, and I would stay far away from them personally, but you know, one or two of them are going to become really popular and profitable. But I think more likely it's going to be the Philip Morris and the British American Tobaccos that are going to make money off of marijuana. It's a new era. It's different this time. It's a permanent trend. What? A permanent trend? There's no such thing as a permanent trend. Markets move in cycles. And then you're going to hear people say, and some of the students in the online class, and if you've gotten involved with the discussion forums, stocks are just too risky. And you have to acknowledge their feelings. You have to acknowledge. You have to basically step back and say, yeah, you know, you're right. There's a lot of risk involved. But even with all the shenanigans and the stupidity and the silliness and the greed and the fear, they're still the best long-term financial investment. And it only makes sense. You're investing in companies. We're in a capitalist society. It seems to be serving us, you know, as best as can be. There's a lot of problems within inequality that we have to address somehow, but how can I say? They've been okay for me. And that, dear students, was our discussion on stock price behavior and market efficiency. Cool? So why don't we stop and let's go to the back to the stop share. And you'll, did I say it? Stop share, there it goes. And let's see who's with us now. We got, oh, Sammy's here, Sam Diaz. And Janet, I got Janet. All right, so any questions, any thoughts? Is this useful to you folks? I hope so. Especially, I love the learning about the buy low, sell high, right? That's right. Yeah, what do people mostly do? They buy high and sell low, right? Okay. that's what goes on. So now let's see what. Okay, great. We got plenty of time. All right, so wake up, and let's hopefully we'll leave some time to talk about the assignments, the discussion forums, and the exam coming up. Let's go back to the guy here, and now we're going to go to, oh, by the way, let's talk about the assignment for chapter 7 real quick. Assignment for chapter 7. Okay, wake up. All right, so now what we want you to do is, the 10-year average is easy. There are these mutual fund screeners at Lipper, and I think they still let you do it for free. Morningstar and Yahoo. Okay, who's done the best over 10 years? But 20, 30, 50 years, that's a little trickier. What you're going to have to do is go into the mutual fund companies. Now, remember there are six in Chapter 4, part of the website, and I think four of these companies are great. Two of them are okay, and so I won't tell you which ones, you decide. And then there are dozens of other companies, and you want to go in and look for lifetime returns or results since inception, or sometimes it'll just say since inception, and see people who have done 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, 80 years, and how well they've done. Okay, so you want to try to see if they've beaten the S&P 500 over 10 years, over 20 years. Notice what happened. The last 10 years have been awesome. Why? Because 2008 and 9 disappeared off the charts. But the last 20 years have not been that great because of 2000 to 2002 and then 2008 and 9. And the 30-year average was more in line with what we would expect, about 8, 9, 10% from 1990 to 2019. So that's your assignment. And again, we hope you have fun doing this. We hope you enjoy digging, because it can be a little frustrating at times, but I believe it's ultimately rewarding. And then optionally, you don't have to, but take a look at the global. Take a look at the global, because it turns out the global results are nowhere near as good as the United States results. And why is that? Well, we bounce back a whole lot faster and quicker, and more our economy was more resilient in the face of the Great Recession. Now, the next 10 years, I don't know. I'm hoping that the world bounces back well. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see. Okay, so now let's go to Chapter 8. Present. That's not what I wanted. Okay, how do I do this? Present with audience Q&A. There we go. Okay, close that. All right, there we go. Now we're ready for some silliness. Any Monty Python fans? I'm a big Monty Python fan. It was a group from the late 60s and into the 70s, and they made some movies and they did a lot of TV shows. And a couple of the folks are still alive and still working, sometimes together, sometimes apart. Behavioral finance and the psychology of investing. And of course, Monty Python is somewhat silly, and some of this stuff is going to be silly. And Benjamin Graham said it well, and of course, he said it before women were included in this world. The investor's chief problem, and even his worst enemy, is likely to be himself. So we would change that now. We'd say the investor's chief problem, and even their worst enemy, is likely to be themselves. And it's the truth. It's the truth. We're often our own worst enemy when it comes to investing. Investor psychology. Psychology? What is that? The study of psychos? I like to call it slycology. And here's a great story. In 1962, there was a brief recession and a sharp market downturn, because throughout the 50s and 60s, the market went in two directions, up and way up. The president's chief economic advisor was giving a presentation to many of the political and economic leaders of the time, describing what they were doing to right the economy. One of the attendees asks, "So when is the stock market going to recover?" The advisor curtly responded, "I'm an economist, sir, not a psychiatrist." And it's true, you know, there's a lot of psychology involved in the markets, but in the long term, as long as you don't panic, it doesn't really mean that much. In the short term, sure, you know, people get panicked. There's three factors that move the markets: greed, fear, and greed. People tend to let greed take over. So, slide number three. Because of the tremendous amount of money involved in the markets, much research has gone into trying to understand investor psychology. Some of it is actually very useful and revealing about who and what we are as humans, not only just as investors, but also as a species. And you'll hear people say, fear and greed, fear and greed. Well, it's fear and greed, because greed usually wins out in the end. And that's actually, you know, a good thing, because it means ultimately we are optimistic. And it turns out that optimists, in general, are happier people, healthier, live longer, and more prosperous. And the pessimists say, well, they're just not reality-based. Oh, well, you know, be ye joyful, even after you've considered all the facts. So, common investor weaknesses. So these may be on the exam in chapter 3, so I'd make sure I understood them, or just wrote them down next to me while I was taking the exam. Reading too much into the recent past. As we said, beware the permanent trend. You'll hear people say, man, this is it, you know, blue skies, productivity gains, we're all going to get rich. Even though there are countless examples of investors getting on the bandwagon just as the wagon was about to veer into a ravine, we trick ourselves into believing that it's different this time. It's a new era. The old way of valuing stocks is gone. Yeah. So ask people who piled into gold or Apple in 2011 or 12. I'll never forget, at a party, this is Thanksgiving Day celebration with a group of folks, some of which I'd never met. And this woman, when she found out that I was involved in the stocks and investing and taught, and she ragged on me for a long time about how crooked they are. Well, she bought Apple as it was going through its meteoric rise, and then it dropped 50%, which is typical of companies that, you know, meteor up, they fall down hard. Sometimes those are great buying opportunities. In the case of Apple, it was, or Tesla, or Netflix, which dropped 50%, I think, four times. In some case, like GoPro, it wasn't a good thing. But she had sold out. And I kept trying to say, well, it's a long-term investment. You have to think long-term. I mean, look how many people are buying their phones this is why people were still getting in line around the block. Now they don't do it. They go online and order them online. But it used to be about, you know, 7, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, people would camp out overnight to be one of the first to have the iPad or the iPhone or the new Mac or whatever. In mid-2008, the oil went to $150 a barrel. And people kept asking me, why is oil so expensive? And I kept saying, well, do you buy it? Do you use gas? Yes. Well, it's because of you. I said, what do you mean it's because of me? Well, you're buying it, right? If you stop buying it, the price wouldn't be that high. And sure enough, the Great Recession came and people stopped buying oil as much, and the price went down to 39 or 29 or whatever. condo conversions in mid-2006, and then there are dozens of companies. You guys never heard of them, but eToys and The Globe and DrCoop.com and CMGI and AOL, all these internet companies that are long gone, although a few are still around, right? Amazon is still around, eBay is still around, obviously Yahoo, even though, but Google, okay. But Google's actually became public after the bubble burst. Misperceiving randomness. Even though stock price movements in the short term are random, our brains will trick us into seeing a pattern. Why? Because we humans are heuristic, which is a fancy way of saying we look for patterns. Even if somebody tells us or we know that there is no pattern to be found, we look for one. And we trick ourselves. In a series of 1 million random digits, you went along zeros to 9 million in a row random. The probability that one digit will be repeated 13 times in a row is essentially 100%. So if you have 1 million random digits and you don't see that, that means that's not a random list of 1 million digits. Somebody's been goofing with it. And if you saw that, you would say, well, that can't be random. But it is. So this, in my humble opinion, is where technical analysts are guilty. They perceive something in a pattern when it ain't really there. And we'll take a look at that in just a few moments, so stick with us. We should have enough time to go through that. Okay, now, being overconfident, believing you know more than you think you do, or believing that you're better than most other investors. The truth is, folks, we as individual investors sitting in front of our computer, maybe downloading the value line or going to the library and getting the S&P and value line and a few other companies analysis and looking at the 10Ks and the 10Qs, we only see the tip of the iceberg with regard to what's happening within the company, the industry, the economy. That's why I liked looking at companies based here in San Diego, because I could go to the annual meeting and talk with the employees and, you know, listen to the presentation, of course. We are usually only average or mediocre investors at best, especially if we decide to become speculators or traders. And this is a common psychological test. In a room of 100 people, you know, you ask 100 people anonymously, are you a good, excellent, good, average, fair, or poor driver? And 80% of them will be excellent or good, typically, sometimes more, right? Wait a minute. You know, that can't be right, right? And so it's called the Lake Wobegon effect. And some of you probably never heard of Lake Wobegon, but it's a very famous mythical place from an author by the name of Garrison Keillor, who says, Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average. So, of course, you know, they can all be above average, but that's what everyone thinks. Oh, my child is gifted. My child is above average. And so we think we're going to be above average. And the truth is, you know, if we're average, that's fine. If we're average investors, we're going to make money, assuming the world doesn't end. If we're excellent investors, congratulations. But how many of us are excellent? We'll find out. You know, you'll find out, especially when you compare your long-term results over people who are being paid great amounts of money to do it. And some of us are actually poor, like Mr. Charles Stedman, who stubbornly stuck with his mutual fund for decades and returned minus 43%. And that's a bad combination. When you get somebody who's stubborn, at the same time they're incompetent, you know, usually people, when they don't do a good job, they eventually give up, right? And it's true of traders and speculators. They start, and within a short period of time, they realize, you know, this is not for me. I'm not doing a good job. But when you're stubborn and you refuse to give up, ooh, that's a bad combination. And then one thing we've already made a mention to, selling your winners too soon and hanging on to your losers. It's called loss aversion. As humans, we hate to admit we made a mistake. So we stubbornly hold on to our losers, hoping that they will at least get back to where we bought in. The reality, dear students, is our memories are hardwired to forget unpleasant experiences. If you sell your losers, you'll quickly forget about them. You won't think about them. But if you hang on to them, every time you look at that screen or your statement, you're going to be reminded how stupid you were. So sell the losers. If you bought it at 10, it's now $6 or $3 or whatever, and you wouldn't buy it now, it just doesn't look like it has a bright future, get rid of it. In contrast, hanging on to your winners is what makes investors rich. At least that's what the people have told me who I believe, and it's worked for me. Hanging on to the winners has worked for me. Peter Lynch was once asked what his worst investing decision was. And, you know, he has a real wry sense of humor. And he said, well, you know, I bought Home Depot when it came out, and I was really impressed with the company, and it went up 100%. I doubled my money and I sold. And they go, Mr. Lynch, that's your worst investment? He goes, yeah, it then went up 20 more times. Which I think it's a cute story. In other words, hang on to your winners. Don't be too quick to sell companies that have done well, especially when you go back and look at the fundamentals and say, you know, well, it looks pretty good for the foreseeable future. They're one competitor, or they're a basket case. The other competitor, okay, maybe we should buy the other competitor too. And so be careful about selling your winners too soon, but hanging on to your losers. So, dear students, we have gone through all the fundamental analysis that we're going to do in this class, because we won't have much time at the end of the semester. We're going to have to cram a few things in. So you know everything that we are going to learn about in fundamental analysis in this class. There is obviously more. There are dozens of models like the ones that we've used that you can experiment with and learn about. But I think you'll be well served. I'm well served just by the discounted cash flow model is my favorite. That's fundamental analysis, the in-depth study of the financial condition and operating results of a firm, a method of evaluating securities by attempting to measure the intrinsic value of a particular stock. Fundamental analysts study everything from the overall economy and industry conditions to the financial condition and management of companies. Simply put, the value of a stock is influenced by the performance of the company that issued the stock, which just makes common sense. The valuation models from Chapter 6, the financial ratio that we looked at in Chapter 17 and looked a little bit in Chapter 5, those are fundamental analysis tools. Some of the fundamentals on slide 9, the competitive position of the company. Is it Coke, is it Pepsi, or is it Monster? Its composition and growth in sales and earnings, the profit margins, the dynamics of the company's earnings, the composition and liquidity of corporate resources, what assets are available. In other words, can they withstand a brief, hopefully brief, severe recession? The company's capital structure, how much debt do they have, how much equity, that's called the capitalization of a company. But there are many investors who don't follow the fundamentals. And those are called technical analysts. They use technical analysis. This is the study of the various forces at work in the marketplace and their effect on stock prices. Those who adhere to technical analysis believe that they can predict the future value of a stock by analyzing the behavior of the stock price's history and/or the overall stock market as a whole. They use any one or many of what are called technical indicators. And simply put, the future price of a stock is influenced by factors other than the company's fundamental future outlook. Okay, so before we dig into this, I want to tell you up front that I think this is bogus. It's great if you want to fool yourself, if you want to fool others, but I would really like to see the long-term results of various technical analysts who actually have made money over the long term using this technical analysis. And then, of course, it's not an either-or situation. Some people are, 50-50. They do 50% fundamentalist, 50% technical analyst. So there's this broad spectrum where the only technical analysis that I even look at is what Value Line, when they have their one technical analysis indicator, which they say 5 or 1 or 3. 1 meaning it's a good time from the technical analysis, their technical analysis. They don't tell you what technical indicators they use. They don't tell you how they do it. They just give you a number from 1 to 5. But we're going to see a couple of the indicators in this presentation. But just so you know, I believe it's bogus. But you're going to hear other people say, no, Payano doesn't know what he's talking about. Here, use this, read this book, use our software. It's only $50 a month. Or come to our presentation for $3,000. We'll teach you how to be rich. Okay, let's take a look at the argument in favor of technical analysis. Stock prices do tend to move in tandem to the stock market as a whole. When the market is rising, most stocks rise with it. You'll hear the saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. But then, the same is true on the other side. When the market is falling, most stocks are brought down with it. Yes. The rebuttal, though, is this is just supply and demand at work. When stocks are in favor, yeah, prices rise. When stocks have become out of favor, prices fall. But repeat after me, there has never been a reliable methodology for predicting the short-term behavior of the stock market. You know, one company did it in the 1990s called Long-Term Capital Management, and they actually did come up with a reliable methodology for predicting the short-term behavior, but it quickly broke down. And everyone thought, oh, these guys have done it. They figured it out. And then it turned into a nightmare. And it was a prequel, if you will, like The Hobbit to The Lord of the Rings. It was a prequel to the destruction that happened in 2008-09, where companies loaded up on tremendous debt to buy the securities that they thought were going to go up. And when they did, they made tons of money. And when they went down, they lost tons of money. So no, if anybody's done it, I'm sure they're not going to tell the world when these people say, hey, I did turn 50,000 into 3 million. Right. You're going to tell other people how to do it? Wrong. Okay. Some of the tools of technical analysis. Momentum buying. The trend is your friend. Where stocks are going up, you go up. Stocks are going down, you go down. The support levels, the resistant levels, we'll see these discussed. The support level is a price below which a stock or the market as a whole is unlikely to fall. Well, who determines that? Well, your software, or you somehow divine that that's what the support level is. Or the resistance level is the price of which it won't go above. And they just look at squiggles at a line and say, okay, here's the support level, here's the resistance level, but then there's a breakout. Well, yeah, they don't stay in... Prices go down or go up, they're not going to stay where they are ever. So we'll take a look at the support levels and the resistance levels. The psychological barriers. People like round numbers for some reason. They like zeros. So 30,000 in the Dow, 3,000 in the S&P. Now we're talking about the support level at the bottom of the S&P at 2,000. It hit 3,000, now it's down to whatever it is, 2,600 or something like that, and it went down to 2,200 or so. So they're saying, oh, 2,000 is a support level. It's not going to go down there unless it goes down there, and then it'll break out to the downside, and then all hell breaks loose. And we're going to look at the moving average. This is one of the indicators that's probably the easiest to understand. An average price or index level calculated using a fixed number of previous days or levels, 50-day versus 200 days, 15-day versus 50-day. It's a very simple indicator, and we'll show how to do it. And your assignment for Chapter 8 is a bonus assignment that You are going to try to convince me that you know what you're doing, even though you don't know what you're doing, but that's okay because I don't know what I'm doing. So you'll do a very good job of convincing me if you simply just try to convince yourself that you know what. Anyway, let's take a look at one of these people in action. All right, let's go to right here. And that's this one right here, this YouTube guy right here. And there are dozens and dozens of these folks. All you got to do is type in technical analysis into YouTube or whatever. So I skipped the advertisement about the chart guys. And what he's going to do is he's going to look at Apple. This is a few years ago, 2016.
Looking at Apple on the daily and weekly time frame, another bullish day. We are riding this upper Bollinger Band support to the upside. That shows a very strong trend. That support is currently 102.06 and will need to be updated with the open each morning to keep an eye on that level. We have seen increasing bullish volume, higher lows and higher highs, and resistance is now the high of today, 103.75, and then looking up at the 105 range where it was previously support back at the end of last year. Keep in mind this is a bearish reversal spinning top, the upper wick and the lower wick with the small real body. Shows a bit of indecision, and after this uptrend, that indecision can be translated to weakness. So we'll see if we get a red day on Monday. If we lose the upper Bollinger Band support, we'll be looking down at the $100 psychological level of support. Looking at the weekly, very strong bullish week. Resistance is up at 106.38, the middle Bollinger Band, and 107.59. And you can see where that 105 level comes in as it acted as support multiple times. Now going to be resistance. We'll be watching for a bullish MACD cross if the bullish activity continues next week. And we'll see how long the bulls can hold this upper Bollinger Band support. So far, so good for the past 4 days. If you like this video, subscribe to my YouTube channel. I put them out daily. The website again, thechartguys.com. We would love to teach you technical analysis. We do so through live interactive webcam during trading, educational videos, and a growing chat community of diverse individuals willing to share their knowledge.
Okay, so my apologies. The thing started. I don't know what it was doing. We can listen to it again. It was trying to call me or something. But do you understand what he's trying to do? He's looking at the price movements and the volume and these Bollinger bands. I'm not exactly sure what they mean, but they're sort of the range in which the stock goes up and down. And he's identifying places where the stock will not go below. And a place is where, who's trying to, what is going on? I gotta turn this off. Stop it. Okay, my apologies. Stop it. It's still, I can't believe it. Something's weird. Somebody's trying to call me. And I can't, let's turn it off. Let's see if that turns it off. No, it's not turning it off. I apologize. Okay, so here, he's identifying places where he believes the price will not go above and not go below until certain things happen, and then there'll be a breakout to the upside or a breakdown to the downside. And is he asking about Apple's products? Is he asking about Apple's earnings? About their competitors? About how much debt they have? How much cash they have on the books? Are the dividends they're paying? He's not looking at anything that has anything to do with the company. All he's looking at are these squiggles on a piece of software that he wants to sell you, and you do the same, and that is going to determine where it happens to the price. And I think it's just BS, personally. You decide. And then there's this other guy. I don't know if we should go. Well, all you got to do, really, folks, is just type technical analysis into YouTube. And analysis, tutorial for beginners, technical analysis stocks. And you will see thousands and thousands of here, new pattern, imminent reversal, five profitable indicators. And you will see dozens and dozens of these guys and gals trying to convince you that they know what they're doing when they really don't. So we're going to show you the easiest. Whoops, that's the wrong thing, not that one. Did I just stop it? Did it stop? I think I stopped the share. I apologize. I think I just stopped the share here. How are we doing for time? Yeah, okay. Let me show you We'll come back to this because we're not going to finish up. But let me share the screen again. And I'm going to show you what we're going to do for an assignment. It's again, an optional assignment. It's a bonus assignment because it's bogus. So let's take a look at a certain company. And who do we want to look at? Why don't we look at somebody really high-flying like Netflix. Okay, so Netflix. And, oh boy. I don't know why I use a Yahoo. There it is, finally. And there are companies like Yahoo, MarketWatch, a few others, that give you some technical analysis tools for free. And then, of course, they want you to, you know, sign up for their premium. And so if we go to chart, so here's Netflix. It's up 4.5% today. We go to chart. And let's take a look at the, I like to look at the 5-year. Okay. So the 5-year is here. So here's the squiggle. And here is this is the last 5 years. And notice Netflix is a very volatile stock, dear students. This is what we'd expect. You know, it was at, you know, 400 and it went down to 250. So 240. So what we're going to do, see now notice they have dozens of these indicators. These are all technical indicators. There's the Bollinger Bands that people talk about. And I really don't understand. I mean, it has something to do with a range. And there's, look at all these indicators. And you're going to study all these indicators and use them. And they're going to tell you why H&1 is fabulous and fantastic. The most popular one is the simple moving average. So with a simple moving average, we're going to use the 50-day moving average. And what this means is it just goes back 50 days, looks at the stock price, and averages them. And what that's going to do is it's going to smooth out. You see the smoothing? The blue, or what's like blue-green, is very erratic. Whereas the purple now is smoothed out because we go back 50 days. And average up the prices. And then we're going to add the 200 day. Some people use the 50 day and the 200 day. That's popular. And let's change the color to this sort of burnt red, I guess. And so now what do you see? You see the 50 day and then you see the 200 day. And you see how it's far more smoother. Well, this is the one that is used, talked about often the most. When the 50, now this didn't happen. There wasn't a crossover here. But when the 50-day crosses over the 200-day on the upside, which it did year, if we go back, let me see if we go, yeah. There it is, right there. There was a time that the 50-day went below the 200-day. That's supposed to be a time to sell. Well, it wasn't in this case. Then the 50-day went above the 200-day. That was supposed to be a time to buy. So it's called the golden cross when the 50-day goes above the 200-day. And it's called the death cross when the 50-day goes below the 200-day. In this case, there's not a whole lot of times it's been stayed above. But if the 50-day were ever to go below the 200-day, that is supposed to be a bad sign. So many people, the technical indicator folks, the technical analysts would say, well, you need to use the 15-day because there's not a whole lot going on here. So let's go to the 15-day because there's not, you know, you're not seeing a whole lot of change with the 50-day and the 200-day. And so now we see times. Now we see times when they've crossed. So now we're shortening our time horizon. We're using the 15-day and the 50-day. So the 50-day is the purple. The green is the 15-day. So here was a situation where the green went below the 50-day. The 15-day went below the 50-day. That was a time to sell. But then when it went back above, that was a time to buy. So in this case, it worked. If you sold here, that was not a good time to sell. But if you bought here, that was a good time. But now, look, it goes below. The 15-day goes below the 50-day. That was supposed to be when you sold. No, no, no. You should have sold back here, right? Not back, not here. It's too late because now it goes below. The stock is going back up. So I'm not a big fan of this. As I told you, I think it's voodoo. I think it's ridiculous. But, you know, you decide. And all you have to do is convince me that you understand what you're talking about. And I'll say, sure, sure. Even though I don't know what you're talking about, but probably neither do you. So any questions on that? Let me stop and ask if I went too fast. I know this is the problem. I'm just sitting here talking and I can't see the chat. Okay, so let's go to the assignment sheet for chapter 8. And we'll continue with this technical analysis on Thursday. But here's the bonus assignment. And what you're going to do, and this is why I say, this is, you know, really, folks, you'll be doing it and you'll be going, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. But that's okay, neither do I. There are many technical indicators. We'll just concentrate on one, the simple moving average. If you want to use any of the others, go right ahead. If you want to use the Bollinger Bands or the exponential moving average or the some of the others, I don't even know what they're called. But we try to find a stock here, Verizon, for which it, there are some times when there are inflection points. The 200-day, the 50-day goes above the 200-day or goes below the 200-day. And so do answer these questions to the best of your knowledge. And if you want to try some other stocks, Medtronic, United Technologies, Budweiser, go right ahead. It's up to you. And then it might speak to you. You might decide that, hey, this is pretty cool. I'm interested in this. And if it does, congratulations. Because then you can fool other people into thinking you know what you're doing, even though you don't know what you're doing. And so here it is, as we'll just end here, because we'll come back to this and review on Thursday. Here's the Starbucks with the 50-day and the 200-day moving average. There's the 50-day going below the 200-day moving average. Wait, no, I'm sorry. There's the 50-day. The 50-day is the red. The 50-day is going above the 200-day moving average, and that was supposedly a good sign, and that was the time to buy Starbucks. And I guess in this case it kind of worked, but I don't know. Okay, so let's review now. We went through Chapter 7. Some of it's silly, some of it's important. I think in studying people who are very good at what they do is, I think, always a good way to learn. And then we went through some of the silly things you're going to hear people say and stupid sayings. Looked at some of the common investor weaknesses. And then we started technical analysis, and we'll continue that on Thursday and review for the exam. Okay, exam number 3. This is, if you didn't do well on exam number 2, fine. That's okay, because here's your chance to redeem yourself. Go back and study chapter 5. Look at the study guides. Go back and study the worksheets in Chapter 6, because the same material from Chapter 5, the same material from Chapter 6 is going to be on this exam. This is the material you just have to know. You just have to know it, dear students. And then the calculations from Chapter 17, we can review a couple on Thursday. Look at the assignment sheet. Look at the formula sheet. They'll be there also. And that's, you know, pretty straightforward, not too much for that, not too difficult. And then that's it. So there'll be a few pieces of information from 17, 7, and 8, asking you about financial statements, asking you about common investor weaknesses and the like. There's not a whole lot of meat in chapters 7 and 8. It's mostly just all, what's this saying? Mostly sizzle, no steak. Not a whole lot of steak, but a whole lot of sizzle. And we'll review again on Thursday. So don't forget the discussion forms. We need your input, starting with the Chapter 5 discussion forms, which are due at the end of this week. You will be, they'll be part of your grade, not the ones before that, because we weren't online before that. But we want your input. Any questions on the discussion forums? If you do, send them to me. You can go look at the discussion. If you walked through Canvas, you saw them. If you're walking through Canvas, but also if you just go to chapter one, here's the discussion forums here. Discussion forums assignment and the commentary and how to add your picture to discussion boards. We want to see your smiling face. Okay, so that was our presentation today. Any questions, any thoughts, any ideas? I hope you're enjoying the rest of the class in our new and improved and safer distances. Any comments, any thoughts? Okay, so I'm going to stop the share, and we'll come back to finishing up Chapter 8 on Thursday. We'll do some calculations, and the exam will start Thursday evening and be available till Sunday. Okay, any questions? Do you know the hangman? Sorry, do I know the hangman? Andres, what is that? Is he still here? No, I guess not. Okay, thank you all. I'll stick around for a while if you have any questions. But I'm going to stop the recording now. Okay, so where's the... Or stop recording. Yes.
The recording has stopped.